From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Happy Saturday. It is August 15th. Well, on today's show, from Cyclospora to the long-awaited Farm Bill, farmers have had to navigate some challenging issues that have taken the national spotlight. Rosie Starr chats with Brent Habig of Two Creek Farm about the latest headlines. This weekend marks the 57th anniversary of the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair. Jason Dole caught up with artist Lisa Law about the community-led effort at Woodstock to feed more than 400,000 people. Plus, we visit New York State's largest private trout hatchery, the Beaverkill Trout Hatchery in Livingston Manor. All of that and Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report, but first, news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. A new aircraft carrier is on its way to the Middle East to replace the USS Abraham Lincoln. The ship has been deployed for more than 8 months without a port call. Reports of food shortages, plumbing problems, and declining morale are raising concerns about conditions aboard the vessel. NPR's Ava Pukach says the replacement carrier is expected to arrive in about a week.
The USS Washington is headed toward the Middle East from its current location in the Pacific Ocean. It will relieve the USS Lincoln, which has had a record deployment of more than 250 days out at sea. There have been reports of lacking supplies and mental health issues among sailors. Acting Secretary of the Navy Hung Kao said the Lincoln's mission was extended because the conflict with Iran demanded it, and that, quote, a small number of mental health cases were treated with no loss of life. Democrats are calling for the Pentagon to investigate and take accountability over the conditions on board. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said concerns about the USS Lincoln were, quote, misrepresented, and said the U.S. can maintain the naval blockade on Iran indefinitely. Ava Pukach, NPR News.
Tropical storm Lala is gaining strength as it makes its way toward Hawaii's Big Island. The storm could bring damaging winds, torrential rain, and massive flooding. In Honolulu, emergency workers are trying to move people living outdoors to safety. Emergency Services Director James Ireland says officials are especially concerned after an earlier storm brought heavy rain to the islands.
And in the previous Kona Lo storm, we found people even in the downtown area, that were hypothermic. They were completely soaked from head to toe.
No hurricane has made landfall on Hawaii's Big Island since 1871. Search and rescue operations are underway in Indonesia after a powerful earthquake struck early this morning. Emergency crews are combing through the rubble of collapsed buildings, searching for survivors. Christina Kukula reports at least 38 people are dead as aftershocks continue to shake the region.
The magnitude 7.7 earthquake hit at a depth of 9 miles off the Indonesian island of Flores early on Saturday morning local time. The quake sparked widespread panic and sent residents scrambling to reach higher ground. Early reports suggest it has caused heavy damage, though police say power outages in cities and villages are hampering search and rescue efforts. Tsunami warnings were issued in the aftermath for parts of eastern Indonesia, which have since been lifted, as the strongest aftershock measured a magnitude of 6.1. The Indonesian archipelago is a region highly prone to earthquakes and volcanic activity. For NPR News, I'm Christina Kukula in Melbourne, Australia.
This is NPR.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Kimberly Izar. There may be some good summer news coming out of Sullivan County. County officials say the sales tax picture has slightly recovered during July. Sullivan County reported the steepest sales tax decline of any other county in New York State for the first half of 2026 at 5.3%. That's according to the latest numbers from the state comptroller. Here's Sullivan County's communications director, Dan Hoos, with more on the sales tax bump.
Our county treasurer, Kathleen Lara, who tracks it very closely, reported to legislators yesterday that automobile sales have been particularly good. They're $7.7 million higher this year than they were this time last year. Also, gasoline sales, which you would think would go along with automobile sales, $7.3 million higher, although I think that also has to do with the fact that gas prices are higher. So we're going to be collecting more sales tax on that. We have restaurants seeing a nearly $5 million increase this time over last year. And then we have department stores. We're seeing those sales are up $2.7 million. And lawn and garden sales are up $2.2 million.
While increased summer sales have offered a glimmer of hope, Hoost says the county still has some ways to go to make up for the current deficit.
We still have a lot left to go. We have about $41 million we need to collect between now and the end of the year. So we're right now, of course, in our big collection season. We'll see what happens as autumn goes into winter.
This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, cyclospora, extreme weather, and the long-awaited Farm Bill, the federal legislation that sets national agriculture policy, farmers have had to navigate big local and national stories the past few months. Farming Country's Rosie Starr visited Brent Habig, owner of Two Creek Farm in Wayne County, Pennsylvania, to chat about some of these latest headlines.
Two Creek Farm is located in Lakewood, Pennsylvania. Their farm practices honor the life in their soil, the animals who share the land, and the forests and fields that sustain everyone. There are no chemical inputs. All the food produced there nourishes both body and a connection to nature. I sat down with farm owner Brent Habig to discuss current challenges that Two Creek Farm faces in 2026. Here we are sitting in a shed crowned by fresh garlic and surrounded by the smell of fresh onions. I love it. Say hello, Brent, and welcome back to Farm and Country.
Hi, Rosie. Welcome back to Two Creek. Always a pleasure to speak with you. Very happy to have you here today.
I see you at the farmers markets over eggs and very picante arugula, which I love. But really, I wanted to come up here and see how it was going in 2026. I mean, it's up and down like a roller coaster. How is Two Creek Farm managing with the weather changes and everything else that we're dealing with right now?
Well, we are doing great. We have a really great crew this season. Very excited with the team. We run an apprentice program and got a fresh group of trainees here. And the weather has been very up and down. I think the extremely cold winter we're coming out of seems to have slowed pasture growth a little bit, but it was nice to just have a normal winter. Sometimes when winter is getting too warm, it just seems to throw things off. In all of the cold, we did not lose a single hive, and we have 32 honeybee hives on the property. So they actually did better in the cold than they do in previous years where it can be warmer and giving them mixed signals. Mm-hmm. So we entered the season in good shape, and we've had quite a bit of rain. It's been hot, it's been cold, but we're pretty resilient to all of that. Mainly we're doing grazing here. We do have some veg production, but mainly grazing. So just keeping wet enough. A lot of the excess rain doesn't really benefit much. It just runs off, but we do have enough to saturate our fields, and it's cool enough in between the hot spells that we're getting pretty good grass growth. So, you know, my concern mainly is drought. And if, you know, we had long droughts the late summer, early fall of both 2024 and 2025. So I'm hoping we don't see a prolonged dry spell. That's the biggest problem. Rain, a little extra rain is not the end of the world as long as our fields are saturated. Of course, all the storms, we've lost a lot of trees, ash everywhere, but you know, the storms are getting more intense, and that's definitely requiring more cleanup around our fences. And fortunately, all of our infrastructure has held up. But, you know, with storms getting worse and worse, that's a whole other category of risk.
How about in that late spring frost that we have? You have fruit trees here, I believe. Were you impacted by that?
I think most of our apples and blueberries seem to be coming in okay. I think it may have hit our yields a little bit, but it wasn't a complete wipeout. In previous years, we might have a complete wipeout in terms of apples or blueberries. This year is not too bad. The frost was earlier than some of the later hard freezes we'd had in previous years, so not too bad here, although at a community level, I know a lot of farms that were more focused on fruit production did get hit pretty hard.
Yeah. Well, that's a bit of good news. And also, you have silver pastures, which is why your soil drains so well.
Yeah, we have a very high focus on soil health and grazing in a manner that builds very resilient pasture with just more life in the soil and more content. So we move our ruminants, our cattle and sheep, we move those daily. That gives them fresh grass. It also then allows the grass a long time to recover after they move off of it. So it gives a lot of growth when we don't have animals on the pasture. And all of that is throwing a lot of carbon matter into our soils, and that then allows the soil to retain more moisture. We also do, in many of our larger fields, we are planting trees in a variety of configurations using a system called silvopasture pasture. And that, again, helps with the resilience. It can help with the small water cycle. It can offer just some additional shade and some cooling. So I think it's very beneficial relative to if you just have a huge field with nothing but grasses in it, then that's going to get quite hot, quite dry, and maybe not build up as much carbon as it would at using the systems that we are.
Mm-hmm. News this summer about the cyclospora. What is your take on it, and are you put upon by this? Are people approaching you in the farm stands asking you about it?
Yeah, I mean, the fact is our industrial food system is extremely fragile. And this is just similar to COVID at a smaller scale, just another example of seeing the cracks in a system that is, at the end of the day, quite precarious and prone to risks, prone to production risks. We saw this also with avian influenza. So I think all of this, to me, points to the benefits of a decentralized and more localized food system. We have seen a lot of new customers coming to farmers markets with just the inherent trust that local lettuce here will be safe, and the feeling that we just don't know what we're getting at the grocery store. And as unfortunate as the cyclospora problem is, if it does help nudge us towards a system that's more local, I think that's better nutritionally. I think that's better in terms of supporting local economies. You know, we want vibrant rural economies, and that doesn't happen through large-scale vegetable production that's highly concentrated in a few parts of the world that happens by offering your spending to local farmers and finding the best produce that you can right at your market. So yeah, lettuce sales are up, and hopefully those customers learn about what an incredible food system we have at our local farmers markets, and they stay, and they don't just go back to big box in a way that I think was largely the cycle of COVID. We had an enormous sort of renaissance of local agriculture, but then as the big box stores resumed their supply, then most of the customers went right back. And I think we just need a more permanent shift and just a deeper understanding of what's at stake in terms of our food system and how much power eaters hold in terms of where they decide to buy their food and what that means nutritionally, what that means in terms of environment, and what that also means in terms of supporting farmers and their local economy more broadly.
I've talked to you enough to know that you're very involved in Washington in terms of animal rights and, of course, about farms. I mean, you have a 100-acre farm that used to be a dairy farm, and you've regenerated it. Now, I understand the farm bill, the current farm bill, has been formed but not ratified. Your farm or local farms, how are they managing in this political climate? What are you hearing from legislators, especially here in Pennsylvania? How are you managing to navigate farm bill versus your way of life here on Two Creek Farm?
The short answer is the farm bill really does not serve local farms like Two Creek, and arguably doesn't really serve farmers at all. I think it would be more accurate to call it the agrochemical bill, because the farm bill is mainly subsidizing commodity production of GMO-based soy and corn production all in the Midwest. And most of that money is going to the chemical companies, it's going to all of the equipment manufacturers, it's going to fuel. So it supports a type of farming that's industrial commodity crop farming, but most of that is not actually eaten as food. It's going into livestock food, it's going into bioethanol. So we call it a farm bill, but it's actually extremely disconnected from the type of farm that you imagine it might support or from a farm like Two Creek. So the unfortunate consequence of that is it allows the substrates of industrial food to be subsidized by the federal government. So we're able to now produce highly processed foods at a cheaper price and flood the market with foods that are ultimately damaging to the health of Americans in a way that's supported by subsidies of the government. And that really doesn't make much sense. There's another component of it that focuses on SNAP and offering food relief, things like food stamps, and I think there's a lot of important benefits there. And then there's some very small components focused on conservation. And those, while optically are good, they're kind of much, much smaller than the environmentally damaging practices that's essentially the core of the legislation. So it's almost like a way to sort of dress it up and appease environmentalists such that it might be, you know, more attractive on that level, whereas at its core, it's extremely damaging environmentally to be supporting all of that use of glyphosate, all of that use of GMO-based row crops, monoculture, so on and so forth. So from my perspective, not a huge amount to celebrate. The new farm bill will be closer to a status quo that we're familiar with, but ultimately nothing in there I would consider a big win for Two Creek or farms like Two Creek. This is really just a simple story of the world's largest chemical companies lobbying to support the type of agriculture that continues to allow them to achieve windfall profits.
Do local politicians or people from the Assembly, the House and the Senate in Pennsylvania here in Wayne County, do they take an interest in farms like yours?
Yeah, we recently had our representative in the House, Representative Bresnahan. He came out and spent a few hours on the farm. We gave him and his aides a tour and were able to talk through sort of exactly what I just said. You know, I delivered in quite an unvarnished manner my assessment of how U.S. federal farm policy is really not doing enough to support farms like Two Creek. And at some level, I think we'd be better without any government intervention in the food system, or an intervention that's more balanced and really supporting food. So yeah, I think there is interest. How that goes back in terms of the policies that Representative Bresnahan might support, obviously that's something that we'll track and continue to engage in lobbying. I'm also working with PASA, the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. They were able to ultimately invite Representative Bresnahan to come here. So it's a part of their broader sustainability and regenerative agriculture policy platform. So this is just a part of a long lobbying game, but it's a game in which we're undergunned. You know, the amount of time that I can spend or PASA can spend in D.C. is a drop in the bucket compared to companies and their armies of lobbyists who do nothing but lobby 365 days a year. Living in Washington, we're flying in, we're down there a few times a year. It's just not a fair fight in terms of the amount of time that we have to command the attention of legislators to really shift policy in the direction that would support small farms in Pennsylvania or New York State.
What would you like the outcome to be from a visit with Mr. Bresnahan?
Representative Bresnahan was very engaged, and I think he could see what we're up to, how important it is. He could see our team here, how we're training farmers. He's particularly interested in apprenticeship and how we can train the next generation of farmers, and that's a big part of what we're doing here as a training farm. So I think there was a lot of interest around that. I think there was a lot of interest around how we can produce food in a way that is at scale, that can offer significant amount of food to our local community, but do that in a way that is in harmony with ecology and a healthy ecosystem. So I think there was a lot that I suspect was eye-opening, and at a personal level was, you know, as to me, seemed to be quite interesting and compelling to Representative Bresnahan. But on the other hand, you know, when you go to cast your vote, that's a complicated set of decisions, many factors at play. And so that's something for us to, you know, continue to monitor and support. But just as far as taking in the promise of small farms in Pennsylvania to revitalize our economy, to produce incredible food, to create jobs, all in a manner that is supportive of strengthening our ecosystem. I think he was definitely excited by what he saw. But again, the translation to votes is complicated. There's many factors, and we'll just continue to, you know, to engage in lobbying to sort of manage follow through in terms of key legislation.
I'm happy that he had an opportunity to spend time with you. He spoke to somebody very respectful and knowledgeable about farming.
At a fundamental human level, we are all connected to agriculture. We exist as a species for the length that we've been on the planet because we have innate skills and understanding. We're able to communicate with animals. We understand plants. We want to have our hands in the soil. We experience the excitement of growing vegetables. And I think there's something very deeply human about agriculture. And I think in a sense that that's something that I felt Representative Bresnahan and his team could kind of a little bit connect to through seeing farming and just getting excited about it and seeing it in a way that's very human-centric. We have our hands in the soil here. We're working all of our livestock on foot. You know, we're not an industrial farm doing everything on tractors or with heavy stock handling equipment. So this is the way humans learned and adapted and evolved to work in contact with the natural world to produce food for tens or hundreds of thousands of years. And I think just connecting back to that is really important to just ground what matters in terms of life and in terms of the food system that we want to build.
That's beautifully put. And that's why you're so successful and surrounded 365 degrees here with animals and agriculture. I can hear them in the background chirping and greeted as I approach the farm by the Katahdin sheep. Yeah. Are you doing your farm tours?
Yeah, we have done a few. We have one more coming up a Labor Day weekend, the Saturday of Labor Day weekend. I believe that's September 5th at 3 p.m. And we're coordinating with PASA to conduct that event through the PASA network as well. So that'll be on our social, and we have sign-up tickets available on our website, twocreek.net.
Thank you. Before leaving Two Creek Farm, I walked through a fertile, regenerative pasture with contented grass-fed grazing Scottish Highland and Galloway cattle. Information on internship programs, farm products, and their two-hour walking tour is available online at their website, twocreek.net. TWOCREEK. .net. This is Rosie Starr for Radio Catskill.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, the latest Star Talk.
This week in This American Life, Janet McNamara is a stand-up comedian. And this weird thing kept happening to her where people with autism would come up to her after her shows and say, just to let you know, you're autistic also. So she got tested.
And the guy just looked up from his notebook and he goes, people with Asperger's generally have above average IQs, so.
That's his week.
This American Life, tonight at 6 on Radio Catskill.
This week on CatsCast, we're off to the Phoenicia Playhouse, where the Shandaken Theatrical Society is celebrating its 50th anniversary.
I mean, they started their whole experience to theater on that stage. Now they're doing their first actual role on that stage. And hopefully they'll come back when they've made a name for themselves and help us raise money on that stage.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency is fighting for its life.
I've never been a big fan of FEMA. It really doesn't get the job done, you know.
FEMA's a disaster.
FEMA's a dirty word.
People are waking up in droves to the FEMA camps.
How did the agency tasked with saving us become so distrusted and despised? On this week's On the Media from WNYC. This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Kimberly Izar. You're listening to Farm and Country here on Radio Catskill. Well, you know what time it is. This week's Star Talk report from Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. In July of 2024, a meteorite crashed through the roof of a home in Hillsborough, New Jersey. Fragments of the meteorite, weighing approximately 3 pounds, were found scattered across the room. Once the pieces were analyzed in a lab, it was determined that the meteorite belongs to a rare class of meteorites. The results of the analysis were released last month. The Hillsborough meteorite, as it has been called, was found to contain amino acids and other organic compounds. The rock also contained microscopic fractures that were filled with a material that suggested the parent asteroid once had salty water moving through it. A high concentration of salt and briny fluids can create molecules that are crucial to life on Earth, and the meteorite contained some of these molecules. This does not mean that the Hillsborough meteorite contained evidence of life, but it does suggest that these rare types of meteorites could have brought the building blocks of life to Earth. Cameras across the New York, New Jersey area recorded the trajectory of the meteorite, allowing scientists to trace where in the solar system the space rock came from. Scientists suspect that the meteorite was once part of a 45-mile-wide asteroid from the inner asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter named 163 Aragon. The Hillsborough meteorite is now considered one of the most scientifically valuable meteorites because of the organic compounds it contains. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future StarTalk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and StarTalk, this has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks to Keith for that report. Well, the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair took place 57 years ago. On this weekend in 1969, farmland in rural Bethel became New York State's third largest city when more than 400,000 young people turned up for 3 days of music, mud, and more. Food for Love, the hired food vendor, didn't have nearly enough food for that many people. So why aren't there more stories of people being hungry at Woodstock? Well, partly because local community members donated food, and partly because some attendees came prepared with food to share. But perhaps the biggest effort to feed attendees came from the hog farm. This Texas commune was hired by organizers to help with the event. And when thousands of people were already camping at the festival site days before the concert even started, hog farmers realized Woodstock was going to be big, and the crowds were going to be hungry. Lisa Law is a photographer, author, and activist who was with the hog farm at Woodstock. She convinced festival organizers that they needed to set up a free kitchen, traveled to New York City to buy bulk grains and equipment, and bought up entire rows of vegetables from Sullivan County Farms. She recently returned to Bethel Woods, and Radio Catskill's Donna Fellenberg, host of Catskill Character, joined Lisa Law on one of these golf cart tours. Donna was at the original festival, too, and this was her first time taking this kind of tour. Radio Catskill's Jason Dole was also there, and so was Bethel Woods Museum curator Dr. Neil Hitch, as Lisa Law remembered the lay of the land and what it took to feed the masses.
So we were brought to an area here that is not part of their property now, so they don't drive into it.
You
can see it?
You should walk down here.
It's overgrown.
Oh, okay.
And that's where the kitchen was, right over there. And the free stage was down there. My teepee was over there.
To go down there.
And right here is where the first hog farm kitchen was. It was feeding people before I built that other one.
Wow.
Or designed that other one. So we had it was a dome, and it had a wooden floor, and this is where people were cooking for all the people that were now camping out here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we camped out over there, and I designed a kitchen right there and five food booths, which I showed you in the picture.
Right. So there were actually two kitchens.
Right.
Did you keep both of them open at the same time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Because this was the hog farm kitchen, and this was the kitchen for everybody. And the kids that had parked themselves over here started cooking. They were the cooks for this kitchen over here. Our group was the cooks here. And when I left to go buy all the stuff, I said, here's what I want you to build. Kitchen here and five food booths. And that's what they were cooking when we arrived back. They were actually building those, finishing up the building of them. And then I had two tents behind my kitchen, and that's where I put all my supplies in the tents. So they had coverage. They're covered.
And any of those supplies in the museum now?
No.
Oh, when you say supplies, you mean like the grains and... Yeah. Okay.
But the kitchen pot, the pot that I told you that we got at the yard sale is now just to the right of the door when you go into the museum, you'll see the pot.
Oh, I got to see that.
Yeah, it's now got its own place, and I just gave it to him a couple of weeks ago.
You know, the Hog Farm Kitchen is here for, I think, at least 2 weeks, and they're feeding 200 people a day, I think, but you didn't supply that food. Where'd that food come from?
That came from the buses. They already had a bunch of food on the buses, like Further.
Yeah.
Further had food and Roadhog had food.
Food for the hog farmers?
Yeah, I mean, that's right? That's what I'm
thinking. Yeah, they were feeding. And then my aunt was here, but she's in a lot of my footage, wearing the red shirt. She loved to serve these people. And so she was serving food to everybody. And there was tons of food, salads and vegetables and bulgurweed. And there was tons of food. And you could see it in the footage of her serving the food.
But the problem is, like, again, and we looked at these dates yesterday, like August 12th or 13th, you realized that we're going to have to feed way more people than the food we brought, right? Like, when did you come to that realization? Immediately when you got here?
I didn't even think about the food that was in here. Because this was little bits of food, little bags over here, little bags. This was feeding our group. What we had to feed is the masses. And I knew that those four buildings up there on top.
Yeah, the food for love.
They were going to run out of food. I just knew they would run out of food. And so I said, we got to get some more food. And the girls were saying, I'll get some pots and some rice and start cooking. And I said, that's not going to do it. And you see, there's 50,000 people already out there in the lawn. I recognize that I know how many times a day I get hungry. And so that's when I went to John Moore's.
Yeah, you knew that almost immediately, as soon as you checked it out.
Yeah, I had to get out of here and go get the food.
When you went to the city and took the truck, you and Peter White Rabbit took the truck to the city, were you getting food, the oats in the city, or were you just getting the kitchen equipment in the city?
No, that's the 1,200 pounds of bulgur wheat, 1,200 pounds of rolled oats, and almonds, sunflower seeds, brewer's yeast, honey. The soy sauce was for the bulgur wheat, and that was for the muesli. So I fed my kids muesli, and I figured, you know, they could eat it, and it would be healthy enough. They needed to be healthy sitting out in the field in the wet. Mm. That's what I considered.
You also got rice? Did you buy rice in the city?
No. Bulgur wheat was it. Rice takes twice as long to cook. Bulgur wheat takes half as long to cook. And that's why I went for the bulgur wheat.
And when you were in the store, then you also bought the cooking equipment. Like, was there an idea
when
of how many?
When I went to Chinatown, I got the big stainless steel bowls for mixing the vegetables. And I should have gotten, the only thing she asked me was there something you forgot? I would have gotten more knives. Because those big, giant cleavers. Mm-hmm. I mean,
was it just two? You only got two, and those are the two?
Two cleavers. But I also got a giant onion cutter. And I love that onion. I don't know where it is now. Mm. And you put the onion in, and you go like this, and it just chops it all up. And then you put it in one of the green garbage pails. And then you have all your vegetables all chopped up in the garbage pails. And then as you're cooking the bulgur wheat, you take a spoon and dump it in and cook it with the bulgur wheat so that you have vegetables with bulgur wheat. And that that was a good meal. And then you put soy sauce on it. I'm totally in the soy sauce to this day.
You got the appliances in Chinatown. You got the bulgur wheat and everything in a different part of the city?
In
Greenblatt's?
Greenblatt's. That's where I bought all the food, in Greenblatt's.
Was that Lower East Side, or?
Well, Peter White Rabbit knew where everything was, and he's the one, that's why he went along. He knew where all that stuff was. And if you see my movie, you see him carrying things out of the stores, you know, the boxes of
the drinking cups, the ceramic mugs.
Yeah.
Were people asking you, what are you going to do with all this stuff?
No, I don't think so, because these people, that's what they do for a living. Yeah.
But they were, like, they're, like in the movie, they are commercial restaurant supply companies. Yeah. So it's, because I thought that too. Like, it seems unusual, but it's probably not for someone to go in and say, I need 12 stock pots or whatever. Do you know how many stock pots you bought?
What are you calling stock pots?
Like the big pot like we have here.
That 10.
10 of those. And they're various sizes. You had got things that were various sizes?
No, I got them all the same size.
All right. And do you remember?
And the other groups took them away.
Do you remember if those were on sale? Like clearance?
No, they weren't. I just went in and saw them. I said,
give me those.
Oh, yeah, I got to have that. And the stainless steel bowls for mixing stuff. I didn't want anything that was aluminum. Same with deodorants. You don't want aluminum in your deodorants.
And you had that John Morris money, too, so you didn't need to look for the sales, right?
Well, on the first day, I had that John Morris.
Well, I just bring this up because in your movie, you have just a couple seconds of a window that has a sale, and it says you can see through the window that is stainless steel aluminum pots, and it says $3.50 was $10.35 or something. So I'm wondering, like, when I see that you clipped that, if you saw that outside and went in and then were like, I want all of these pots. It doesn't matter. It's
probably
just when I'm watching the video.
It was a long time ago.
It's just really interesting.
I like to watch that movie.
Most people have a memory of eating rice. They talk about eating rice with raisins. But if it's all bulgur wheat, that's an interesting
thing. Yeah, but that could have been from this.
Yeah, they could have been eating here.
They could have been eating at the hog farm kitchen. Because the hog farm kitchen, they are serving tons of food. It wasn't just a few things. They are serving huge amounts of food. You'll see it in the movie. But that's my Auntie Lane serving it.
At the hog farm kitchen, which is different than the free kitchen. But also you have to think that the hog farm kitchen is feeding the people that are working. And they're working sun up to sundown, 12, 16, 18 hours a day doing construction. So, like, they're expending a lot of calories.
Was giving us a bunch of food for that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't right here. This is where we made it. It was over there.
You have a picture that shows vegetables. And in the back of that are several stainless steel milk containers that I'm assuming are Yasgur milk.
Yasgur was giving us tons of food and yogurt, lots of yogurt and milk and the water and the big trucks. That's why I was shooting all the people standing in line at those big trucks, because I was trying to show where all this food and water and liquid was coming from. And it was Yasgur.
He brings a milk truck over and people get milk out of the truck, right?
Yeah. He was really helping. He was down here a lot.
So.
Yeah, and he would take the kids away in the morning and feed them and bathe them.
Aww.
I heard that later.
So it's an interesting thing, because I don't know that we talk about this or Yasgur gets credit for that aspect, because he's not getting paid for that, right? And where some of the, you know, we have other farmers that are on camera in the movie saying they had to throw their milk out. Where Yasgur's bringing the milk over here and just giving it away.
Different mindset.
Yeah. All right, you have a last question for Lisa?
Lisa, How does it feel when you come down here to this site? You've been doing this a bunch over the last couple of years. You're definitely doing it a lot, you know, this week. How, when you come down here with Neil like this and you're sitting in the cart with guests like Donna, how does it feel to be here?
Well, this is one of my favorite places to come to. I mean, this was an important part of my life, was being able to serve that many people and to take care of that many people. You know, I always want to 10 babies because I like to take care of them. And these are all my babies here. Yeah. And feeding them. That's why I was taking pictures of long lines at the milk truck or the water truck to show these people that we're taking care of. And so I really like coming here.
You can hear much more of Lisa Law's story coming up in just a few at 11:30 on Catskill Character. Lisa is Donna Fellenberg's guest for the entire episode, so make sure you stay tuned for that. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we visit the largest private trout hatchery in New York State.
Hey everyone, it's Tom Candela from Curtain Call. This week on the show, I welcome back Katie Weatherford from the Greenwood Lake Theater. Now, last year, we talked about a company that was built on grit and imagination. This year, we'll talk about the company's new chapter with Sugarloaf Performing Arts Center, its work with Sugarloaf Arts Collective, and a season that includes Clue, Macbeth, Spontaneous Shakespeare, and Annie. That's this week on Curtain Call, Monday night at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we're doing some island hopping. It's the soulful Puerto Rican home cooking of Omi Hopper and the global flavors of Hawaii remade as easy home hacks by Top Chef star Sheldon Simeon. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
On this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the new host of Reading Rainbow, Michael Threets, talked about how he finally knew he had arrived in his dream job.
You're not a true library person until you've been shushed by someone visiting the library.
I'm Peter Sagal. It's our own Listening Rainbow with sportscaster Jason Benetti, Olympian Lily King, and more on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back. I'm Kimberly Izar. You're listening to Farm and Country. Well, brook, brown, and rainbow trout are just some of the fish at the Beaverkill Trout Hatchery. The Shaver family are the owners of this fifth-generation fish hatchery, which also happens to be the largest private fish hatchery in New York State, right here in the Catskills. I headed to Beaverkill Trout Hatchery earlier this month to learn about the simple joys of raising fish. It's a sunny Friday afternoon just along Alder Creek in Livingston Manor, where Gary Tyler Shaver is feeding several thousand rainbow trout. Shaver warns me that if I get too close, to expect some splashing.
For the most part, they get a little excited and they'll come over and bump you when you get into the pond when you've got your waders on and stuff. The only time they ever start reminding you that they have teeth is probably the browns during spawning season, and that's just because their jaws get a little bit more hooked and a little bit bigger.
Shaver is one of the operators at the Beaverkill Hatchery. It's a fifth-generation trout hatchery on about 175 acres. The rainbow trout Shaver is feeding typically grow a bit faster than the brown trout, he says.
The fastest grower we have is rainbows. Optimistically, on a good year when weather, water, all that kind of stuff is going well, we can get 10, maybe 11 or 12 inches in 1 year out of a rainbow. We're very happy to see 8 out of a brown. Tigers are kind of weird. They're a gender-specific hybrid, meaning you need a female brown and a male brookie to make them. And they're also born sterile, which means they grow a little bit quicker than everybody else. But they grow slow in the beginning, and then once they get to about 10 inches, they start exploding.
The Shaver family has been operating the fish hatchery for 5 generations. Tyler operates the hatchery alongside his aunt, Sherry Shaver, who is the owner and operator of the private trout stocking hatchery. They both sat down with me to give me a bit of history on how the hatchery all started.
The hatchery was founded in 1965 by my great-grandfather Fred, grandfather Edwin, and father Gary. When they founded the hatchery in 65, the theory was they were going to raise trout to sell to private fishing clubs to stock their streams and people to stock their ponds. Through the years, quite a few years, here we are in 2026, still standing tall with the fifth generation coming in. We are the largest private trout hatchery in New York State. We sell, still, most of our trout are sold to be live hauled, stocked live to private waters, but we are also selling a lot of fish to restaurants locally. Livingston Manor is our hometown and has turned around and really rewarded us with a lot of fish we sell down there. We also have a fish and pay pond that's open on Saturdays and Sundays here, where you can bring your own equipment and fish in our pond, one pond only, and no throwbacks. It's $9 a pound, cash or check. Bring a cooler with ice. And there we are.
And what kind of fish do you have at the hatchery exactly?
Hi, I'm Gary Tyler Shaver. I'm the fifth generation. I'm one of the operators on the property. On the hatchery, we have brook, brown, rainbow, golden rainbow, and tiger trout, including the babies, which we are raising right now. And between all the fish that we have, it's probably somewhere between the 250 and 350,000 mark. We ship in New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Connecticut, up north of Lake Placid, and out to Buffalo.
Having the right water and temperatures are both key to having healthy fish, and every season is different.
With the right growing conditions, we can have trout up to 8 to 10 inches in 1 year. That means good water, good temperatures. This year is exceptional thus far. Last year and the year before were horrible droughts. We suffered greatly. We lost fish. Our electric bills were astronomical, but we got through it. Mother Nature is, we're at her mercy every day because we have been through two storms this July, which is unusual. We had a microburst back in July 18th, took down trees, wiped out our electricity. And then we had the flood the other day. So you just never give up.
And how would you, I know you said that two storms just in July, that's unusual. Like, how do these more extreme weather conditions affect your business over the years? And what does this year look like compared to previous years?
Well, water-wise, we're definitely ahead of the game, but it could turn off and be a very dry fall. It just hurts us if we have no water that we don't get the growth on the fish that we need to get. And of course we have high mortality. If you have no water, you can't grow fish without water. So it's looking better this year, but let's not get too excited about it yet.
In short, fish are sensitive creatures. They need the most optimal conditions to grow and to thrive. And at Beaverkill Hatchery, it all starts at the hatch house, where the fish hatch from eggs into finger-length-sized baby fish.
In here is our hatch house. It's kind of where we get our day started. We keep our waders, all of our equipment for getting into the ponds in here. And then we have 12 aluminum vats that we put trays in. The trays get filled with eggs. All the water gets put in, gets washed over them, goes out, and goes out to the ones below it. In here, we come in here during the fall, winter, all that kind of stuff to check the eggs, pick eggs. When eggs go bad, they turn white, so all those need to get picked out or else it can spread to the other ones.
And how do you manage temperature control here? Is that something you have to think about?
It was thought about when it was put together. Everything that's here in here is either by spring or well. Well water is regulated by geothermal, so basically year-round it comes out around 50 degrees. And then most of the spring water comes out around 40 to 45 for most of the year, unless we have a very serious, very bad drought.
Gotcha. From the hatch house, fish head to the concrete ponds and then to one of the hatchery's dirt ponds, which Shaver says is as close as the fish can get to being in natural habitats, but in a controlled environment.
Back here, we have five dirt ponds filled with rainbows and brookies, depending on the pond. And above those, we have two concrete ponds where we have a bunch of brookies from last year. And
I can see just even immediately that these ones are much more mature than the ones we saw before.
Yes, these guys are, depending on the pond, anywhere from 2 to 5 years old. The pond we're passing right now, we've had some 17-inch brookies come out of. Up here, we have probably 11 to 13-inch rainbows, and the same thing above that. And the very top pond, top dirt pond up here, we have last year's babies that grew up, and they are anywhere from 10 to 12 inches right now. These brookies came out really good this year.
Even through the hardest seasons, Tyler and Sherry both say the joy of sharing fish with others is simply indescribable.
I get a big kick out of knowing that almost every day that we're out there catching fish, we're helping some kid or adult or teenager, somebody catch their first fish. Some people I know, when they grow up, then they have their own house in a pond and stuff like that. They always want their own little spot where they can go fishing, and helping put one of those little dreams together or something like that, it's fulfilling.
And Sherry, for you?
I think it's pretty amazing the work that we do. When you start out with an egg and you end up with that egg being the most beautiful 24-inch brown that you've ever seen in your life, that's gratification.
In Livingston Manor, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill. A few happenings the next few days. Tomorrow, August 16th, the Mammocating Environmental Education Center in Wurtsboro, New York, is hosting a sky stitching workshop by Audrey Bartow on Sunday, again from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Visitors are encouraged to sit with the artists while they work, help to observe birds, and check back in as the project progresses. And then on Tuesday, August 18th, the Damascus Community Center will host a community potluck dinner at 6:30 p.m. Attendees are asked to bring a dish, a friend, or simply just bring yourself. Dinner is going to be at the Damascus Manor Community Center in Damascus, PA. Again, that's August 18th at 6:30 p.m. And then next Saturday, mark your calendars, Pines for Public Media is back. You can join Radio Catskill at Rose's Bar in Berryville, New York on August 22nd. We're going to be there from 6 to 10 p.m. And so will DJs James Friedman, Tommy Castro, and Woody Wood Jr. It's going to be such a fun night filled with music, friends, and support of your local public radio station. You can find more events and information up on our website at wjffradio.org. That's all for this week's show. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Up next, it's Cats Cast with Brett Berry. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR. I'll catch you next week.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
It's harvest time, one of the most uplifting times in the agricultural calendar. And traditionally, the English harvest is rounded off with celebrations. But this year, drought. But next week on the Buckaloo Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, I bring you a little harvest joy in the form of songs and dance tunes about the harvest. Join me, please, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Wherever you go, take Radio Catskill with you. Stream your favorite shows, music, and podcasts anytime, anywhere with our new and improved app. Stay connected with local news and national headlines all in one place. You can even send us your thoughts with the Talk to Us feature, audio or video, right from your phone. No radio? No problem. Just press play. It's Radio Catskill right in your pocket. Download the app today on iPhone or Android.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.